My name is Erin Helmerich, and I'm one of the teen services librarians here, and I am extremely excited. We brought Ben all the way from Seattle so he can regale you with their cold weather, too. So how many people are, like, regular daily fans of Eiken Has Cheeseburger and Failblog? All right. How many of you are wondering what the hell those are, and that's why you're here today? Okay. How many of you want to know how you, too, can make money doing things like that? Okay. Ben has several tracks of conversation that he can continue. He is indeed the CEO of the Cheeseburger Network, but I think you will also appreciate knowing that he is allergic to cats. So we are going to take lots of questions. Ben would prefer to save them for the end, so unless there's some like really burning thing you need to know, we'll do plenty of time for Q&A at the end. So without further ado, please welcome Ben Ha.
Thank you so much for being here. Can everybody hear me okay? Is the microphone on? Okay, good. So I'd like to thank Erin and Ann Arbor District Library for bringing me all the way out here. You know, usually when we're stuck in Seattle in winters like this, it's nice to go out and understand everybody else has a miserable winter too. So, so like Erin explained, I am the CEO and co-founder of the Cheeseburger Network. To be very clear, I actually didn't start the website Eiken Has Cheeseburger. It was started by two people in Hawaii, and they didn't come up with the idea of putting captions on cat pictures either. It started out before in a forum called 4chan and a bunch of other internet humor forums. So, but I'm going to lead you through the history of the site. And I'm also going to talk a little bit about internet culture and what it is and how it's impacting our life, especially for the younger folks in the crowd, and how of a meaningful impact it'll probably have over the next 25 to 50 years, just as television changed our world when it came on to the masses in the 50s. So the name Eiken Has Cheeseburger comes from this specific photo. It literally says Eiken Has Cheeseburger. So when the two people in Hawaii, they were dating at the time, and the girlfriend actually found the photo and said, and I am it over to her boyfriend and said, "Don't you think this is funny?" And he just laughed. He laughed for so long, he decided, "I'm going to build a website, and I'm going to call it Eiken Has Cheeseburger." Notice the Z, right? It's not spelled like cheeseburger. It's got its own spelling. And it's called LowSpeak, and I'll get into that. So this was the very first photo that he posted on the site. But let me take you a little bit before in time, and I think some of the older folks in the audience may recognize this poster. This was a poster from, I believe, the 70s, which is a kitten with a caption on the photo. This qualifies as a lolcat, which is a genre of cat photos with captions on it. Right? So this is the funky father of lolcats from the 70s. Well, you know what? We're actually going to go a little bit before that. Okay. Well, if you can't read what's on there, it says, "What's delaying my dinner?" in all caps. This was a postcard found by a fan who lives in Seattle. She was going through the antique stores in Seattle and came across this photo and said, "Oh my goodness, this is a lolcat from 1905. We had her bring it into the office. We scanned it. We declared that this is the oldest lolcat that we know of. But it's also entirely possible that in the beginning of civilization, somebody may have carved hieroglyphic text in front of the Sphinx. And if you can recognize the tail and the arms of the Sphinx, that's a cat. And therefore, I'm still trying to find out if there was hieroglyphics in front of the Sphinx. That would qualify as the oldest lolcat that we know of. So, what's the difference between hanging their cat and today? What's changed, right? Why does a guy standing in front of you today have a job posting cat photos on the internet, right? In fact, it's not just me. There's 32 of us being employed full-time by a company in Seattle that posts funny cat photos on the internet. Now, we've grown to more than 40 sites now. And we basically have a little humor empire that we're building. But in the beginning, the internet changed everything. The internet said, you can no longer just rely on television to get your laughs every day. You can actually create a small community of people who love something enough that they're willing to invest a tiny bit of their time every day to create their own content and share it with each other. It's a meritocratic way of sharing their sense of humor. And what it did was it made it so much more accessible for people. And free software such as WordPress, which is a software that we use for our blog platform, made it virtually cost-free to run this. The very first ICANN's cheeseburger hosting cost Eric, one of the co-founders, $6.99 a month. This entire empire started from one photo somebody created and $6.99 in hosting. It's absolutely incredible. Yeah, we do that every day almost. Every week we launch a new website, actually. So on January 11, 2007, he posted this photo. And by March, and honestly, we don't know why and how people found this website, because there was zero marketing involved. People kept on sending it to other people. And the site grew and grew and grew. And eventually the $6.99 host called us and said, you got to get off. It's costing us more than $6.99 to host you. You got to move somewhere else. So September of 2007 rolls around. I purchased the website with a bunch of investors' money to run a business from it. Well, I'm going to rewind a little bit there, too. In April of 2007, that's when I first heard about this website. Somebody sent me a link, a friend of mine, and said, you really need to take a look at this. It's really funny. So I clicked on ICANN'sCheeseburger.com, and I went there, and I said, I don't understand. I am not sure why you sent me this, because I don't think this is all that funny. A couple weeks later, somebody else sends me a link. You have to go to this website. I've been there before. Try it again. I go there. I kind of don't get it. I don't know. It's a bunch of cats. Why do I care? I don't even have a cat. I have a dog, right? And then the third time somebody sent it to me, I said, fine, I'm going to spend a little bit more time and try to understand this. So this is again in April. I go there. And I don't remember which photo it was, but there was one photo with a caption I saw that I thought was really funny. And a light bulb went off. And I said, oh, I get it. They're like people, but in cats. I don't know what's up with the spelling, but boy, this is actually pretty funny. And I spent some time, and I told my wife, honey, you should look at this. This is really funny. And she came over and she said, I don't get it. Lo and behold, a few months later, we'd be running it full time. So after we bought it, we decided, you know, this isn't a pet thing. When the investors put up money, they said, what are you going to do, lull aardvarks, you know, lull giraffes? And I said, maybe. But the important part about this community was that it loved humor. Just as much as it loved pets and animals, it also loved the fact that for 5 minutes a day, they could get away from what was troubling them and enjoy this virtual world. So we wanted to do something that was different, and we saw a bunch of these graphs out there that wasn't business related. There were people who were taking musical lyrics and putting it into graph form, right? So we said, oh, you know, we could actually build a site that did that. So we actually launched a new website. Had a bunch of staffers actually create their own, which weren't very good, to be honest. Posted an Excel spreadsheet they could download so they can actually punch in the numbers themselves and actually write what they wanted. It was really crude, really rudimentary. And then we put it out there, and we told people in ICANN and Cheeseburger, hey, come check this out. It's not kittens, it's graphs. And they said, ah, it's not that cute. Didn't really work. But what was funny was, even in the grand scheme of things, it didn't really work. There was enough people who liked it enough that they continued to create new content. And we didn't make it easy, right? Like, if you go to ICANN's Cheeseburger, you can take any photo and put a caption on it in, like, 5 seconds. Like, with this, you have to download the spreadsheet. You have to change the values. You have to take a screenshot and email it back to it. I mean, it was really hard to do. But the community thrived. It continued to create new content. And, in fact, they moved away from music, as you can see, and then they moved to actually more everyday life. And it became incredibly successful when we let the insane people run the asylum, so to speak. You know, that was our position. Look, we don't really know what's going to happen to this website. You guys are the ones creating content. So if you guys want to see this stuff, we'll put it up, right? And that's what they did. They took over, and they said, you know what? We're going to take control of this thing. And in fact, we published a book based on Graph Jam called Graph Out Loud, which is musical lyrics in graph form. And then we launched another website. Totally looks like. A lot of celebrity websites were comparing celebrities to other celebrities. And then we said, hey, why don't we turn the keys of the insane asylum to the people who are in it? So we said, hey, we will give you a builder. So you could actually go to the builder and upload 2 photos and rotate it and zoom it and make a comparison. This is done by a user. Notice the very good alignment of the eyes. And they care about this stuff deeply, right? So when we gave the tools for the users to create new content, they did exactly that. And boom, that was a community of people. And we can't obviously leave out the dogs. That language you see there, the dog, by the way, the dog community tends to be more about cute than they are about funny. I think, as a dog owner, I find this pretty funny. It's called LOL speak, L-O-L speak, right? So what's with the spelling of all this stuff? Well, LOL speak is comprised of a bunch of different slang, language, pidgin, Creole on the internet. One's called LEET speak. That's actually L33T. It stands for elite. It's basically a hacker lingo where you exchange numbers and letters to form the actual English words. There's texting. Of course, I'm sure everyone here is very familiar with that phenomenon. And there's common misspellings, such as teh, T-E-H, right? And just spelling a slang on the internet. And also Shakespeare. The reason I bring up Shakespeare is that people who are offended by the fact that their cats can't spell, which happens all the time, email us and say, why do you insist that cats don't know how to spell? And my response to them is, it's actually not that. It's that cats don't want to talk like us because they're better than us. It's a good PR response I've come up over time. But the reason I bring up Shakespeare is that language, English, evolves. Shakespearean English today, read today sounds completely different. And I'm sure that if you read our English to Shakespeare, he would consider this an abomination, right? Why do you guys use English in such a different way, right? Or why do you have thou English? I don't know. So we're accepting the fact that technology and the way we interact with content and everyday life changes the way in which we formulate words and meaning and definition. And this happens all the time. There is no singular English, right? It is how we use it. And then something like this happens. You take a word like fail, which used to exist in one different usage, failure, to fail, and such, failed, and then you turn it into a cultural phenomenon, right? We purchased a fail blog from a guy in London in April of 2008. It had been around for about 4 or 5 months. It was a relatively small website. I went there. I thought it was pretty interesting. It was a low-risk, you know, decision for us. We bought it in April, and then the financial crisis happened in September, where banks started failing. And then the lexicon literally just changed overnight. The landscape of the use of the word fail became more about this than it was about the proper way to use the word fail, right? So lightning hits strikes, I guess, strikes twice. That's really fortunate for us. And we actually started posting videos on it. It's the number one comedy channel on YouTube, and we've shown more than a billion, our videos have been shown more than a billion times, which actually makes us one of the largest independent video distributors in the world, off of one website featuring fails. It's pretty incredible, the power of people, right? And we don't create any of our content. So all of this you see here, I'm not sure what Obama, Harry Potter, and Sonic the Hedgehog with roses has anything with each other. I like this one a lot. It's amazing how quickly you can change the numbers on a window sign. You know? Write it backwards. That's amazing. You know, people asked us, how long do you think this will last? You know, how long do you think Failblog will go on for? And I said, have you seen humanity lately? There will be an inexhaustible supply of failures. For us, it's a matter of maintaining a community that wants to curate this stuff. So we started growing our family. So I've shown you some graphs and things like that. We even entered the political arena with Pundit Kitchen, which we launched just after the Democratic primaries. That was a lot of fun. And then once the election actually occurred, we looked at each other and said, uh-oh, there's nothing to do, right? All the politics had gone out. And then what happened? The community took over and said, you know, it's not about politics anymore. We're going to turn our attention to news. And then started submitting things that were totally unrelated to politics. I said, okay, if that's what you guys want to do, we'll do it. And which has led to more than 40 sites. Our latest hit is called failbooking.com. So Failblog actually originally posted these Facebook fails back in, like, I think, August of, like, 2008, pretty early on. And we saw this popping up all over the place. I said, all right, it's our turn. We better do something about this. So we launched Failbooking, and it shows you how one person's, innocence can lead to pranking by a lot of people in this version. If you notice, there's 106 messages that's been sent to this poor girl. This is an example where people ask the question, how do you keep this going? You've got 40 websites. Where do you go from here? And the answer is, I don't really know. As long as people continue to tell us, and as long as we can continue to spot patterns in the way people use the internet and have fun, we're going to try to create a site for that niche, right? You like dark humor? Great. We'll try to do something for that. Do you like irony as a type of humor? Great. We launched a website called Friends of Irony, right? These domain names, we actually kind of come up in the office when we have had too much to party, right? So the question was asked, where will there be an inexhaustible supply of this stuff? And my answer is, how much bigger is the sun than the earth? Because the way we see the world, it's actually like this. The amount of content that's produced by media versus users, the users completely dwarf the amount of content that's produced by mainstream media. And actually, if you think about it, I think I might have put the slides out of order. The three largest companies in the world, three most influential companies in the world that are media companies are Google, Facebook, and Twitter. Between the three of them, they probably influence more of our everyday media than anything else outside of mainstream media. The commonality between those three is actually the fact that none of them produce their own content. Right? Facebook, who produces Facebook's content? The users. Who produces Twitter's content? The users. Who produces Google's content? The rest of the world. Right? There's a fundamental shift in the way we perceive media today. This is why user-generated content has taken off in the last few years. There's also a secondary factoid, which is that I started a company in 1999. Remember the dot-com boom? Well, I was in the middle of it. And we started a software company, and we wanted to get it out the door, so we wanted to create a product. It cost us $250,000 to create our single product to put it out the door. It was enormously cost prohibitive. Today, the cost of launching a product is virtually zero, right? Technology has come such a long way that you don't need to spend $250,000 anymore. That's why we exist. We launch a new website every single week. And the better part of that equation is that because we can launch something every single week, if something flops, we take it down. We don't have to worry about, oh, we spent all this money creating this thing. Can we try to throw good money after bad? There's none of that discussion. If it doesn't work, we get rid of it. We repurpose the domain for something else down the road. This idea of trial and error is something that we encourage in the office. We actually say we celebrate our failures and we reward our successes. Because if you don't know how to fail properly, if you don't know how to try something, and if you're afraid of failing, you'll never try it again. So I'm going to go back to what it is about this user-generated content that's really interesting for me. And I call it micro-humor. That's actually the very first picture I picked to post on Failblog. And to me, it has the essence of micro-humor. The guy who sent it to me said, this is my friend. She tried to catch a Frisbee, and she fell on her face. I would like you to post this photo on Failblog, please. And I said, why is this funny, right? It's funny to him because it was his friend. But it was funny to me because I have a shared experience. Not that I ever fell on my face like that. I know how to play Frisbee. I've seen this before. Therefore, it is funny to me. I posted it. It is an inside joke that was shared. It's situational, meaning you have to kind of be there to really enjoy it. And it has subcultural references. I used to play Ultimate Frisbee, so I understand what this is like. So I posted it, right? The interesting thing about that is if that was mass media, no one would have cared. If that was on TV, it's kind of like, well, why are they showing me this? Who cares? But because there were enough people who had similar experiences, the demographic of the people visiting Failblog knew what Ultimate Frisbee was. Everybody knows what a faceplant is, which is what I call the national flower of Fail Nation. That photo actually did really well, and it was shared by a lot of people. They said, you know, I can relate to this. Without the internet, without the fragmentation of media, you can't have those people connect and share something like this and enjoy it, right? Would have never made the 6 o'clock news, but it was front page and shown to millions of people who enjoyed it. That's micro-humor. Micro-humor is something that we've grown up with, right? I'll tell you what it is and what it's not. What it is the type of thing that we laugh when we're babies. When your mom or dad picked you up as a baby and tickled you and made that funny face, that's not funny to me, but it was funny to you as a baby. It's a shared experience, this kind of inside joke, right? It's actually most of where we get our laughter from. When you have an office worker who cracks a funny joke about another coworker, right? That's this micro humor, which has been completely ignored by mass media for the last 50 years. In fact, if you look at the days before mass media, this micro humor, this inside joke, was the dominant form of entertainment. That's why courts had jesters, okay? Like, the jesters in 18th century courts did not perform the Eddie Izzard routine he saw from television, okay? That's not what he did. What the jester did was they made fun of things that the royalty knew about, right? They leveraged the inside joke. And what we've done is come full circle. Because we can use the power of the internet to connect all these people who share different types of humor, we can now share this inside humor with a lot of people today. In fact, all these things you see here is a spawn of this thing called micro humor that the internet has enabled millions of people to share. Chuck Norris, the greatest man ever alive, right? Evolution of the dance. This is a guy dancing on stage showing you the different types of dance over history. That's all it is, right? Just one video. Most watched video on all of YouTube's history, right? Where the hell is Matt? It's a guy who goes traveling around the world and dances with people. It's pretty, actually, really inspirational, right? But without internet, no one would ever have seen it. And of course, not to be left out, Rick Astley. So these internet memes have an interesting commonality. Trust me, I will not be playing the song, so you will not be Rickrolled. So you're welcome. So for those of you who don't know what a Rickroll is, I'll explain it very simply. You will send somebody a link to something, and you'll click on it thinking it's a legitimate piece of content. All of a sudden, you'll be faced with this man singing the song, "Yeah, I won't let you down," blah, blah, blah. And you'll wonder yourself, why am I looking at this? That is the Rickroll. It's a prank. It's a very juvenile, simple prank. But this started out as something called duck rolling in 4chan, which is that unfiltered community where Lolcat started. So it started with duck rolling. So you would actually send the link, and the link would actually link you to a picture of a wooden duck with wheels on it. And that was supposed to be funny. And then at some point in 2007, early on, some genius said, you know, instead of duck rolling, I'm going to send you to this Rick Astley video. And then it took off. So this is actually search traffic on Google for the term Rickrolling. So all of a sudden it took off and it became funny. What they did was they took the old bait and switch and changed the context and the meaning of a bait and switch, right? The really weird part about all this is that if you were to send somebody a link to Rick Astley and they clicked on it and they were Rickrolled, you actually received no benefit whatsoever, no reaction of any kind. It's over the internet. You don't know what's happening to the person on the other side. It's not like you're staring in their face and go, aha, I pranked you at the office. That doesn't occur. What actually happens is, because of the internet, that person will come back to you and says, you're such a bleep. And then you know, oh, I did the right thing, right? So this two-way communication enabled this thing called the bait and switch to occur over long distances at any point of the day, right? And all of a sudden, this day was just before April Fool's. And everybody decided that on April Fool's 2008, they're going to Rickroll the world. At the top of the list was YouTube. YouTube changed every single link on their homepage to the Rick Astley video. And therein lies the death, I guess, the birth and death of a meme, right? Now that everybody knew what it was, people actually started building tools that would actually tell you if a link would lead to a Rick Astley video. One good deed is not, yeah, never mind. So this type of humor that we share, it's like if you've been Rickrolled prior to April Fool's 2008, you had this shared experience with other people, right? So before mass media, right, this micro humor, this inside joke was the dominant force. I used the force, Darth Vader, anyway. Here's the misplaced slide. Google, Twitter, Facebook, they don't publish their own content. Thank you very much. All right. And that's basically where we were born, right? This inside subculture of people who decided that putting misspelled captions on cats were going to be really, really funny. And they shared it with their friends. And what happened was a person started collecting it, and then it became a community, then they started to participate, build a language, evolve it. There's actually even a low-speak dictionary, which now spawned an entire cottage industry of meme building. And that's it. That's my Twitter handle. That's my website. If you have any questions, I'm more than happy to answer it for you guys. Yes, back there. The question is, how much money do I make from this? Well, remarkably enough, we've been profitable since the beginning of our company. We started in September 2007. If you guys can remember that far back, that was the beginning of the recession. And I was telling Erin this in the podcast that she did for the library. If somebody would have told me, hey, by the way, you're going to leave a six-figure job as an executive and run a cat picture website, and by the way, for the next couple of years, this is going to be the worst recession we've ever seen in our lifetime, I'd have said, no thanks. But fact of the matter was, I wasn't happy in my job. It was a good job, right? I made a good living, but I was really frustrated. I had a big, giant Fortune 10 corporate client that I was responsible for, and it just wasn't fun anymore, so I was looking for a new job anyway. So when this came along, I decided, you know, I know I didn't get my journalism degree to put cat photos on the internet, but it sure beats the heck out of not being happy. So I left. And now, today, we employ 32 people. We're still profitable and growing. So.
Any numbers?
No. Anyone else? Yes, back there. So we've got a fan of failbooking.com, and she's asking, how do you come up with these new ideas? That's a very interesting question. They strike me at any moment. Like literally, I could be standing here looking at you guys and going, you know, I could take a website of people staring at each other and just analyze their faces. I mean, it's literally just like that. So I'll go to our spreadsheet that we keep in the cloud, right, the Google Cloud, and I'll put down an idea. And then a bunch of our moderators, there's about a dozen different people who work on the editorial team, and they'll comment on it, and they'll say, that sucks, or, hey, that seems like a really interesting idea. Here's a few photos that I found that I think are related to that. And so we'll sit there and refine that. And of the 150 ideas that are on this sheet right now, one or two make it to the top. And that's what we work on for the next week's launch. So, yeah. Yes?
I have a friend from a small European studies program who moved to Seattle and made $10 or $11 million in a dot-com in 1999.
Okay.
And living in Seattle, she decided she'd go into politics, so she ran against Senator Slade Gorton for the U.S. Senate, and her name is Maria Cantwell.
Hey!
And my question to you is, what are you going to do with your $10 million?
The question is, what will I do with all the money I make from posting cat photos online? I actually have a list of things that I want to accomplish in my life on my website, and I'll probably try to do those. So, first, you know, pay off my house and all that stuff. So, yes?
Start a new site and you launch it, how do you seed the market space so people know it's going to start
spreading
about it?
When we start a new website, how do we get it started with content and with the traffic? So one of the most common questions that I get is, I've got this brand new blog, how do I get traffic? And my honest answer is, I don't know. I bought my way into it, so maybe you can go buy something, right? So that's actually the only thing that we know. So what we actually start out with is content. We absolutely want to make sure that the content that shows up on that site is within the expectations that we have, that you have, but acts like a box of chocolates. Okay? You never know what you're going to get, but you know it's going to be chocolate related, right? It's the same thing we do. So on Failbooking, we know it's going to be Facebook related, but we don't really know what's going to show up. And that's kind of half the fun. And that's what we do. And then for traffic, we actually link to it from our other blogs. So we have the ability to actually market internally to our 14 million people who visit every month. So, yes? So the question is, what is my favorite website? And the second question is, what's my favorite within that website? So I'm assuming you're talking about one of our websites. So my favorite still, I guess, Cheeseburger. It's the one that I save till the end of the day, right? It's not the one that I go back to every 5 minutes. Like that one, I'm worried, right? But because I'm in business. What I do is I can achieve Cheeseburger at the end of the day when I'm about to wrap up, and it's going to put a smile on my face before I go home, right? That's what's really important to me. And then secondarily, my favorite photo is actually a kitten with ear hair. Like it's got like hair coming out of its ear holes. And he's sitting like this in a wine glass. He's actually literally in a wine glass on a bar. And the caption says, "Send me with my compliments to the ladies." I don't know what about it that I really love, but I just saw it and go, "Oh, that is so clever." I wish I were that clever. Not a single one of my captions have ever made it to the homepage. So yeah. Yes?
With all these websites, you have users uploading content.
Yeah.
Do you have custom programs that are using off-the-shelf scripts?
So what do we use to publish our content? So there's actually two halves to our platform. One is WordPress, which is the publishing platform we use to actually show the content. And the second platform is the platform that we use to generate the content, to help people build it and for them to save it and such. We spend the vast majority of our efforts on the latter part, which is what makes us different. Anybody can create WordPress to create a blog, right? We use it a little bit differently. We use it as a publishing platform. But what really makes us different is the fact that anyone can show up, upload a photo, add a caption, and regardless of who submitted what, we review it to make sure it's appropriate for the website. For example, I can ask Cheeseburger, everything on there has to be family friendly, right? So we enforce those laws within our community. And that's what really makes us different. So we spend the vast majority of our time building our custom code for that. Yes?
Are you ever concerned about the site's integrity becoming too lowbrow?
I'm sorry. The question is, am I concerned about being too lowbrow? And my answer is absolutely not. And that's a great question. A lot of people have accused us of taking memes and kind of destroying it by publishing it to the masses. And my response is, memes are born to be shared with people, right? For more people to participate. What makes a meme interesting is the fact that you can take your idea and impress it upon the meme to change it and affect it and make it your own, right? So that, in essence, tells me that it's more like a democracy. So therefore, if democracy is the highest order of political structure, then what we do will also be the highest order of content structure, right? More people participating in a fair and transparent system will make the content better for the masses. That's my long way of saying that. Any other questions? Yes, back there.
You mentioned before that when you have a site, you need to come and see if it works out, if it's not funny, you take it down. I'm wondering, how long do you need to give the website to see if it's going to turn out?
How long do we give a website time before we decide it's a success or a failure? That's a good question. It varies anywhere from 2 weeks to a year and a half. And the reason it varies is because we're looking for a community. We're not looking for a specific type of traffic. We never say, if you don't hit these traffic numbers, we'll shut it down. It's not a matter of traffic. It's a matter of finding a small group of people who are so passionate about that website that will continue to create content and share it with other people. Right? I'm going to actually take this back to the business question that was asked, which is, you know, about our revenue numbers and things like that. And I know we say, you know, we're very proud of the fact that we're profitable in this recession. But, you know, a lot of a good business, good fortune comes from good luck. And one of the incredible luck things going for us is that I'll compare it to, being in Michigan, General Motors. Unlike General Motors, which has to buy its supplies, pay its employees to create the products, go out and sell and market it, we have none of those expenses. We do not have to pay for our content. We do not have to pay anyone to create that content. We do not have to pay anyone to market that content. It is no surprise that we are profitable. Right? We have none of the costs that saddle a traditional business. Right? All of our costs go back to creating this community and making sure that they're happy and having fun. That is the core of our business. It's not really even publishing. Right? People see us as a publisher. You make money from ads, therefore you must be a publisher. But at the end of the day, it's seeing all of you show up and be curious about this company that tells us that we are doing something right. Yeah, so I'll break down our precision of income. So most of our income is advertising. The second largest group is our book publishing. So we've published 4 books now, of which 2 have been on the New York Times bestseller list. And those 2 books, based on I Can't Ask Cheeseburger, are a collection of photos with misspelled captions of cats, which is something you can find on a website for free. Actually, when you upload a photo to our website, you provide us with permission to use it in certain ways. So we don't actually, quote unquote, take somebody's rights. That's called a rights assignment. So that's when you actually say, you no longer have the right, and we do. What websites do when you actually upload a photo in most cases is they have a license to use it from you. Any other questions? Yes?
Content,
So will user-generated content become more influential or less influential is the question that I'm going to answer. It'll become absolutely, positively more influential only if filtering becomes better. The fact that we all produce content doesn't mean it's Shakespeare, right? We still need an infinite number of people to produce Shakespeare because we're a bunch of monkeys producing whatever it is, right? We still need that guidance. And the filtering, in our case, is provided not by an expert, but by the community themselves, right? So if I produce a piece of content, I will be judged by my peers. Like, they vote up and down on the voting page, and therefore the best ones make it to the homepage with a few caveats from our actual editors who sit there. Now, this is what enables user-generated content to become more powerful over time. The fact that we're producing more content actually has a devaluing effect on content itself, right? We just produce more and more stuff. The market does not have any demand for it, therefore it goes down the hill. What we have to make sure is that if we produce content, there's a mechanism that tells you this is appropriate or better than other, right? Which assigns value, and that value gets translated into market because people want to spread it to somebody else. So yes, I think overall it'll become a much more important piece of culture today. And that's where I'm going with the idea of TV in the 50s, the internet culture will be to our kids or young people today over the long term, because we have changed the way we understand what media is. Because younger people today spend so much time on the internet, the old paradigm of one-way broadcast TV no longer applies. You have to, if you don't interact with a piece of content, it is no longer valuable, right? It used to be that you didn't have to interact with something to be valuable, but today it does. And that ship has already sailed. And everybody else, the entire media industry, is trying to figure out what that really means to them. I heard a question in the back. Yes? How many people do I work with? We just hired our 32nd full-time person. So there's 32 of us. I'm going to skip you for a little bit. There's another person back there. Yeah. Yeah. How long? We were in trouble since the day we started. Let me give you that answer. You know, one of the interesting things about what we do is that we are in this gray area of a thing called copyright, right? Anybody can upload any photo, whether they have the right or not, to our website, right? The United States of America, God bless this country, because we have this little law, which is very controversial in many aspects, but we have this little clause in a law called the DMCA, Digital Millennium Copyright Act, which states that the service provider, the company that provides a specific type of service, is not liable for the actions of its users. That's all it says. This little, huge law. There's one line in there, which protects service providers. What we do is we provide a service that allows people to upload any photo and add a caption, right? And that is really important to us because that allows everyone else in the world to use our tools to create new speech, right? And I know that sounds kind of legal and kind of out of touch, but I went to London, and I was talking to the Guardian newspaper, one of their big newspapers in London, and they said, we have this huge problem. We don't know what to deal with comments. We don't know what to do with comments. People say whatever they want in these comments, and we have to go delete them. We have to spend all this time managing what people say because we'll be liable if we let it through. So we turned off commenting. That, like, stopped my heart. Because the business felt they were liable for the actions of its users, it prohibited speech. Wow. That is absolutely incredible. In this country, that is not true, right? And that's what allows us to say things like, hey, Guinness Book of World Records, you're wrong, right? Because we have this right called fair speech. We can criticize a piece of work. So anyway, that's a long way of saying, yeah, we've been in trouble all this time, but we kind of like it that way. Yes? So the question is, how do we compete with everybody else trying to ask users to create more content? The first big advantage we have is a thing called traffic, right? And that's an enormous hurdle for other people who are getting started to overcome. So, but it is overcomable, right? People have done it. Facebook is giant. We're just a tiny little sliver. What really prohibits other people is that we are actually focused on creating a small of a community as we can. In order to drive this giant network of 14 million people, we actually focus on creating a tiny little space where a few people can love what they do. And that kind of love is infectious, right? If you love something, I'm a fan of knitting, right? I'm going to tell my friends that they should pick up knitting. There's been a resurgence of knitting in the United States over the last 10 years, right? It wasn't because a giant company that had a lot of yarn in storage house decided, you should all knit. It didn't happen that way. It was grassroots. And that's what we try to replicate. And it's actually very difficult to do that. So that's what we're good at. But whereas competition happens all the time. Sometimes we win, sometimes we lose. We'd like to win, right? We're very competitive. But there's nothing stopping anyone from doing this. We just happen to be really good at it. Yeah. I had a question up here? Yeah. Yeah. Yes, we do. We actually have more than that. If you go to cheeseburger, CHEEZBURGER.com, there was no question there, but I'm going to answer it anyway. You'll see the stats of the currently active number of photos in the archive, currently active number of users registered for the site and such, and it's in the millions, actually. So. And some photos have probably been uploaded 10,000 times. So, yeah. Yes? So the question is, did I take any skills away from the corporate world? I actually had a client who was a Fortune 500 company, so I actually worked for a pretty small firm. But that's okay. It's actually a very valid question, because even though we were a company of like 30 people, I think, we acted like a corporation. And the lessons that I learned were to what not to do in my company. And it was absolutely incredible and eye-opening to learn those lessons, because I'd always been a startup guy. I'd always loved working in a small environment, entrepreneurial, places where you can innovate and fail and try it again. And all those things I learned from corporations were the opposite of what I wanted. The politics, the defensiveness, I show up to work because I just want a paycheck, right? Just didn't like that. So when I started my own company, I wanted to do specifically the opposite of that. How do I get people who love what they do, who love the mission of the company? So when people started telling me in person or over email, we didn't have a mission statement. They said, I go to your website, and this, actually this one lady was sent me a very touching email. I print out your website every day, and I was really alarmed by the number of trees being killed. And she said, I print out your pictures every day, and I go to my grandmother, and she's recovering from cancer in the hospital. She doesn't have internet access. She doesn't know how to use the internet. But I show her these photos, and it brightens her day. And that really touched me. I said, okay, we're on to something here, right? And I heard it again and again in different people in different ways, and where they said, you are the 5 minutes of happiness that I get in my drudgery of work. And so we adopted that as our mission, right? If that's what our users are already telling us, why have a different mission? They already like what we do. We just needed to clarify. So our mission became make people happy for 5 minutes a day. And it doesn't seem like rocket science, right? It doesn't seem, we're not curing cancer, we're not saving any lives, but it seems to have a real impact on the people who visit the site. So, yes, over here.
Do the companies that advertise on your website, do they come to you at a certain point, or did you go to them? How do you get the advertising?
Sure, how did we get the advertising for the website? We are one of the largest wholesalers of ad inventory in the world. I'll explain that. There's two ways to really make money with ads on the internet. One, you sell it yourself. Hey, Coca-Cola, I've got this website. I'd like you to buy some ad inventory. It's called direct sales. The second is, hey, Google, I know that you have ad inventory. You can show it on my site, and I'll take a cut, and you can take a cut. We mostly do the second part of that, which is we wholesale our inventory to a bunch of ad networks who then resell it to their clients. So we don't have a salesperson at all in the company. Yeah, where can you start with advertising? So we started out, it was being run by somebody else, but they put ads relatively early on in the company's history. And it generates a few bucks a day, right? It doesn't really add up over time. Only when you reach a huge scale of websites do you start to actually generate significant dollars. So it wasn't until we reached about 500,000 pages a day, which was when I bought the website, that you could sustain one employee's salary. Yeah, it takes an enormous scale. Yes?
Do you and other
Booking
employees have an actual physical office space together?
So what's our office like? So it's about this big. It's filled with cat litter. And everybody's trying to wrestle down a cat to put a caption on it. No. We have about a 1,500 square foot office that we're subleasing from another company. It looks, there's actually a video on YouTube. It's called Behind the Scenes at Failblog, which is actually seen millions of times. And then all the comments are like, wow, you don't work out of your mom's basement? It's actually true. That's like half the comments. We have, everybody gets a 2-foot by 4-foot folding table, like including myself. So there's about 20 some of us in the office, and we have employees, one in Indiana, a couple in Texas, one, he's from New York, but he lives in Poland now, one in LA, one in Vancouver. So all over the country too, but most of them are actually out of our office in the shadows of the Space Needle. Literally, I can go out the door and see the Space Needle. What a cliche for Seattle, right? So that's where we are, and we all sit out in the open space, and yeah, it's pretty egalitarian, if not Spartan. Do I have an office cat? We do not. We have lots of employees with cats. We sometimes bring my dog in, and he doesn't know what to do, so he climbs on things, which is very cat-like. But yeah. It's back there. Are there translations of Lowell speak in other languages? So I was invited to a conference in Brazil. It's like, great, free trip to Brazil. So I went, and I said, well, what do you guys know about our network? I mean, you guys speak Portuguese, and we speak English. And I said, oh, don't worry. Internet is universal. They're like, really? They're like, yeah. People here say the word fail, even though they don't speak English. It's like, apparently, the word fail kind of sounds like feo, which is in Portuguese ugly. So apparently it translates. So it actually turns out that the internet, which is shrinking the world and actually making it diverse at the same time, has this universal effect in the way it impacts internet culture. So there is no other language for Lowell speak, but apparently we don't need one. So, yes?
You talked about community a lot tonight, and you're out on YouTube and your site. Do you see any potential for leveraging community in the future that really hasn't been utilized yet?
Is there a new way to leverage community in the future? Absolutely. We are literally not even, we're scratching the top of an iceberg. I mean, that's how far we've come when it comes to the internet as to harnessing a community. There are companies today creating software and techniques and ways to have communities do more, ever more complex things, right? Because the very first thing you do with a community is to do one thing, one variable, right? You test the one variable. If they do it, then you move on to the second variable. So as the internet becomes faster and more powerful and more people do things on the internet and also become culturally comfortable with sharing their information and content on the internet, the possibilities of doing something greater increases geometrically. It wouldn't be out of the question for people to crowdsource a large piece of machinery a few years down the road. In fact, that's already started. I have a friend who runs a company called the MakerBot. What he does is he creates little kits that you can put together that allows people to create 3D objects. You can literally print an item using software. So I don't know if you guys remember, some of you may know this, back in the 70s when the computer revolution was getting started, you would buy a kit computer through the mail order. And this is an exact analogy. And a lot of those pieces are crowdsourced. One person will make a widget, somebody else will make another piece of tool, and you actually print the two items together, put it together, and you have a piece of machinery. It's absolutely phenomenal what people can do. Yes? You got a question back there? No? Yes, back there? Yeah, so the question is, because of the amount of content that flows through our system, have you considered an automated algorithmic system like Digg.com? So if you aren't familiar with Digg, what happens is people submit links to Digg, and people vote on what they like and what they don't like, what they believe is newsworthy. And based on a specific secret algorithm, they will put the most popular from that hour to the top of their page and such. So it's called social news, social media aggregation. Have we considered that? Absolutely. We've actually tried it. And what we found is that one of the problems that we have with a completely automated system is that we have no control over the guidance of that community. Right? We're at the mercy of the masses. And somebody can actually come in and influence the system in a way that we don't like. So what we decided was, this is incredibly expensive. Half of our company is devoted to the task of filtering content. Right? So if a bunch of people decided that they wanted to see something risque on I Can't Eat Cheeseburger, they can literally hack the system to a point where they can have that show up automatically. Whereas with our current structure, that is impossible. Every piece of content that shows up on the homepage of I Can't Eat Cheeseburger has been filtered 3 times. Once by the person who screens all images and categorizes them. Second, by the community through a voting system. So there's a voting page that you can actually use to actually indicate what you like and don't like. And third, by a professional editor who screens all the stuff that the users have decided is of high quality and decides what to put on the homepage. This is really cost intensive, but we feel that this is a unique structure that makes our community better than others. So. Any other questions? Yes, back there. How long does it take to go from something that's submitted that people like to the homepage? It literally takes anywhere from hours to weeks. I could literally come up with an idea today, make a phone call, and it'll be up next week. Yeah, so the turnaround from an idea to an actual website, that's the question. It can be incredibly fast. We've actually tried a test. We saw a trending topic on Twitter, and we decided that we wanted to turn it into a website, and it took us 2 hours. Right? We can literally respond with the news. Right? I unfortunately wasn't watching the VMA, so the whole Kanye West thing, like Taylor Swift, I wasn't watching it. So the next morning I woke up and there was like 6 websites already. We're like, forget it. Too late. So, any other questions? Yes?
What's the key from having websites with pornography or people using drugs? Or
what keeps the really bad stuff out? The answer is there's people. We have paid staffers who look at this stuff, and they'll just reject it if it doesn't meet our editorial guidelines. There's a question. Yes. How did we hire and get the people we had? We posted ads on Craigslist. And we started out pretty small. We posted some ads on Craigslist, and it worked. We got a few applicants, and then one day I got frustrated. I said, look. We're a low-speak-based website, so I'm going to write a job listing that says, you don't need to know how to spell to work here. Please apply. The position's based out of Seattle. The Associated Press and the Washington Post picked it up and said, in this economy, you can get a job without knowing how to spell. News at 9. So we received 1,000 applicants from across the world. And it was literally just reject the entire pile because we couldn't go through that. So, feast or famine, I guess. But we're getting pretty good at it. People know who we are in Seattle. We're actually the largest startup in Seattle in terms of traffic. So we've actually gotten a bit of notoriety. Actually, it's pretty funny. I tend to kind of say things that sometimes I regret, like most of us. And it gets picked up in the news. So that's kind of weird. But that allows us to generate enough applicants to actually hire. We get an average of 150 applicants per job. So, any other questions? What are we looking for in our positions? So. This is what are we looking for? So our job applications, because we have so many people, go through a system that you have to upload your resume and fill out a bunch of questionnaires. And there's usually 10 questions per job applicant. And the questions focus on two things. One, what are your values? Things that are inherent to you that isn't learned at a job. Second thing, what are your skills? What do you know how to do? The most important part of those two sets is the values. What do you like doing? How were you raised? Those things are really important to us because chances are you didn't earn a degree in cat picture screening. Right? And no one has told you how to nurture an online community. We're going to have to teach you that anyway. Right? So what we're interested in is people who believe in the same things that we believe, no matter what your background is, no matter what your education is. I don't care where you went to school. I don't care that your last job was a bank teller or dishwasher. I care that you're smart enough to answer those questions to the best of your abilities and that you share the same values of putting users first and working hard to make sure that happens. And that's most important to us. Now, there's technical jobs that require a very different set of skills, but half of our company is based on that 10-question questionnaire. So. Yes, back there. What top three things do I suggest they consider? This is the do as I say, not as I do portion of the Q&A. So I was actually born and raised in Korea for the first 11 years of my life, where math and science and all the things that makes an Asian country Asian was taught, right? Let's be honest. And then I moved to Hong Kong, and then I learned English. I actually spoke the Queen's English. Of course, I lost that when I came to the United States. Very unfortunate. I came to the States when I was 14, sophomore in high school. And the thing that struck me the most was that kids didn't spend enough time in school or reading or didn't really seem to care as much. And that really shocked me. And then by the time I got to college, I had lost all the advantages of coming from a system that was really highly focused on education. And when I got to college, I went to Northwestern. I went to their journalism program, which is a fairly selective program. And I had to compete with kids that went to like private schools on the East Coast. They knew who Kafka was. Like, they knew like high-grade physics. I mean, things that I was not prepared to even know about, they knew. I actually had no idea what a fraternity was until my sophomore year in college. I'm like, oh, there was no Wikipedia to help me. So I don't know what the magical future holds, but really find something that they're passionate about and turn it into a real lifelong curiosity. And that's really the best. Like, I hated math and science. The first thing I did when I realized that the journalism degree did not require me to take any math classes, it just needed statistics, which is like math light. It's like, oh, I took stats. Didn't need to take any more math. Right? I really liked publishing. That's what I really enjoyed. I liked communicating. I liked, ironically, writing in English. It's a second language that I speak, not even my first language. But that really made me curious about the world. So that's what I did. So, yes. Yes. Yeah. Oh, well, that's not a problem. I'm perfectly fine with people taking books and not actually buying them to read. We're in a library. Yeah. Ouch. That's the first time somebody's told me that the book has caused him enough pain to cry. You're welcome. Yeah. Yes. Ah, I'm sorry. Maybe I glossed it over. What is a meme? It is spelled M-E-M-E. It is coined by a science fiction writer back in the mid-70s. The definition of a meme is an idea that is propagated from person to person, right? Think of a revolution. The meme of a revolution is the idea in which they're fighting for. In internet parlance, meme is a piece of content that people contribute to the framework of the content. So ICANN's Cheeseburger is the leading site for the meme called lolcats. Lolcats are pictures of cats, mostly, some animals, that have a misspelled or funny caption on it. That's all it is. It's the framework for this type of content. So, yeah. Yes, back there. Do I have a favorite meme of the lolcats? Actually, I loved it so much I built a site around it, which is Graph Jam. I came from the corporate world. Often, we would use Excel spreadsheet to do things that it wasn't supposed to do. And I was very happy to find other people who shared the same passion. So, yeah. Yes? That's right. Yeah. So the question is, how do we trend spot, right? Most of the things that we do have a basis somewhere else. Somebody said, a great person, I'm sure, because it's carved in a rock somewhere. Good artists borrow; the best ones steal. Picasso said that. The reason I didn't know who said that was because the great graffiti artist from London named Banksy crossed out Picasso's name, apparently, and wrote his name underneath it, right? So it's a very clever thing, and that in and of itself is a whole new meme, right? So what was the question again? how do I trendspot? Right. I probably consume more media than is healthy for a normal human being. Right? I look at enough internet content. And actually, it's gotten easier over time, where people send me stuff, and I don't have to look for them anymore. I just kind of sit back and let the emails come in. So I've actually gotten even better at it, no thanks to myself. Do I have employees or jobs? No. We don't have employees whose jobs to go out and find trends, because we hire people who are going to do that anyway. Right? So it's like their passion to go home at night and surf the internet for funny stuff. And they come in the next morning and be like, hey, I saw this yesterday, or my friend sent me this. We should try it. Right? When you hire the right people who share the same visions, they're not really working. They're just having fun with a paycheck. So, any other questions? All right. Well, if that's it, thank you very much.